Recently, President Obama issued an apology after saying the California Attorney General, who happens to be a woman, was by far the best-looking Attorney General in the country. This hour, gender and politics. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests this Politics Day, Diane Bystrom of Iowa State University and Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa. We'll also discuss the strategy behind the president's budget, Margaret Thatcher's legacy, and potential candidates for an open Iowa congressional seat. Join our conversation. It's Politics Day, starting right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and welcome to Politics Wednesday. Our guest analysts this week, Diane Bystrom, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. She joins us from our Ames studio. Hi, Diane.
Hi. How are you doing?
Okay, very good. I know you had a few technical problems
Yes. We just went live. Yeah.
Yes, we did just go live. Diane, welcome to our program. In addition to we have joining us by that good, true, and tested technology going back probably a century. Bruce Gronbeck is on by phone. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing fine. Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies. Good morning for you, Bruce, because you're out in Colorado. We are into the afternoon hours, just barely, and we have a number of things we want to talk about. Of course, a primary focus of today's program, we want to look at gender and politics. Been noticing a number of those things bubbling up in our news having to do with that. The intersection of gender and politics. We want to talk about that. Before we do, let's talk about President Obama's budget unveiled this morning, his proposed fiscal year 2014 budget plan in the White House Rose Garden. That announcement, he offered a combination of new spending initiatives, tax increases aimed at creating jobs, reducing the future budget deficits. He called for $1 billion in the creation of a new manufacturing innovation institutes. Also, $50 billion for repairing highways, bridges, mass transit systems. Also, Congress would, he said, would have to make some changes to Medicare to reduce future outlays on that program. But, quote, they don't have to be drastic ones. So President Obama increasing taxes, his proposal, by $580 billion over 10 years. And any thoughts on the strategy as we've been watching this over the last few weeks? Let me start with you, Bruce Gronbeck.
Well, I was struck by how parallel it really is to the deal that was hammered together in December to combine tax cuts and some relatively modest new spending measures, making a move that at that point picked him up about $2.5 trillion, for those of us who can say that word but not understand that amount of money at all. And now another $1.8 trillion to get to where they knew they had to get sooner or later, which is somewhere over $4 trillion over the next 10 years, using the same strategy where he's going to be able to say, you've done it before, now let's do it again.
Diane, your quick thoughts on this before we move on.
Well, I think I agree with what Bruce said. It is a lot similar to what was put forth a couple of months ago. I do think he'll have the same rhetorical theme, is that Republicans have supported parts of this package in previous years. I also like this time around what the president's leadership this term as compared to his first term. You know, in his first term, I think he was very much trying to use sort of a collaborative bubble-up model of leadership, with having, you know, Congress come together and make these proposals. And that doesn't work very well when you have a Congress that's divided as we do today. And so I think he's really showing a lot of leadership. Of course, he's in his second term and has more freedom to do so. But I like the fact that he's laying things on the table. It's already been attacked by the right and the left. So usually when that happens, he's probably got something that he's put together that is a compromise.
Okay, let's move on to a major focus of our hour. And we'd like to have our listeners join in our discussion. Your thoughts on gender and politics. How far have we come on gender in politics in the last few decades? Are the sexes treated differently? Can you point to instances where they haven't been treated the same way or where you think we are getting better in terms of that? Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or post on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. Well, when we look at gender and politics intersecting with our news, recently we have to go to President Obama's apology after saying that the California Attorney General, who happens to be a woman, was, in his words, by far the best-looking attorney general in the country. At a White House briefing the day after these comments, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney told reporters the president had apologized to the California Attorney General.
The president did speak with Attorney General Harris last night after he came back from his trip, and he called her to apologize for the distraction created by his comments. And, you know, they are old friends and good friends, and he did not want in any way to diminish the Attorney General's professional accomplishments and her capabilities. And I would note that he called her, in those same comments, brilliant, dedicated, and tough, and she is all those things. She has been a remarkably effective leader as Attorney General. She is a key player in the mortgage settlement, which will help many, many middle-class families who are struggling to deal with the mortgage situation in this country. And, you know, he believes and fully recognizes that the challenges women continue to face in the workplace and that they should not be judged based on appearance.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney there. Diane Bystrom, much criticism of the president for this. Some defenders out there, too. Is the criticism deserved or being too sensitive here?
I think the criticism is deserved, and I feel like when we call it out on one side, we have to call it out on the other, and we certainly have called out a lot of Republican comments during the last campaign. I think it was inappropriate to me. I study gendered media coverage and gender and its effects on women's representation in government, and basically, yes, he did call her brilliant. He did call her tough, but by talking about her appearance, he elevated her appearance as a qualification that would be on the same level as being intelligent and brilliant and tough. I think the other thing it does is even more disturbing, I think, is that there's been a notion for some time that attorney general, both federal and state, those are sort of masculine offices. We don't see a lot of women even holding those offices. And so they're we have a very masculine expectations for those offices. So it was almost like, too, that, you know, here she's in this, you know, masculinized attorney general's office, and hey, she looks great, too. So I thought it was totally inappropriate. I think he should have apologized. I was happy to see organizations like She Should Run and Name It, Change It, and the media, the Women's Media Center, all called him out for it and used it as a, you know, what they said as a an opportunity to educate people on how harmful those can be. If you want me to a little, there's also been a study around the same time about how talking about a woman's appearance resonates with voters in a very negative way.
Right, right. Do tell us, because isn't it any mention, whether it's positive, negative, neutral, about a woman's looks in the political arena, can't have any good consequences.
Yes, there's just a major survey research report that came out on Tuesday. It was done by Celinda Lake, who's a longtime Democratic pollster, and also Chesapeake Bay. I think his name is Ken Carpenter. I think he polls on the Republican side. They polled 1,500 voters over sampling for young women, and they basically did this hypothetical survey where they would call these voters and say, they would describe Jane Smith, and I think Bob White was the guy's name, and they would describe him. They'd read a story about them, a full story that they had created. And in one story, they were described neutrally about their appearance. One was positive and one was negative. And what they found is that whenever the woman was described at all, either positively, negatively, or a neutral, it decreased the voters' favorability of the woman candidate. They were less likely to see her as an effective leader. They thought she was less likely qualified to hold office. And ultimately, they said that they wouldn't vote for her. And on the other hand, there was no ill consequences for describing a man's appearance.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Gronpeck, you study the media, and specifically political media and messaging. What is your thought on why this hurts a woman in the political arena, even if it's a complimentary remark?
Well, I think because it becomes a distracting factor. Raised on classical rhetoric, where your job is to understand people that favorably if they have good sense, goodwill toward the audience, and good moral character. This becomes an extraneous factor. Now, I think as we got going in the early 60s and began to talk about the youthful revolution of politicians and the handsomeness of the Kennedys, and you moved on through a series of other people like Gary Hart running, all of whom were being praised for their vigor, yes, but also their handsomeness, that it became somehow part of a political package to comment on such things.
Right. But we say totally he looks presidential. That's something that we accept, or are we supposed to phase that out?
Yeah, that's I think a little different thing. Then he has a countenance that presumably does mean that he has good sense and experience, that he does care about the people he's addressing and seeking the vote for, and that he does cut a positive moral figure on stage. But we got so pulled off to the side on that issue of physical description and vigor and athleticism and a whole series of bodily aspects that it became very distracting, much the same way it had in, if you think about the media revolution in the 50s and 60s, where finally in a great study at the end of the 60s, women were being called, set dressing, essentially, because of that, the whole kind of emphasis. I think it gets in the way terribly, and I agree that that's the study that Diane mentioned really says it not doesn't simply get in the way and distract, but it becomes a negative factor.
Diane Bystrom, you have some of your own research that looks at if this is becoming more or less likely in coverage for people running for elected office. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, here's the good news. It is getting less likely for women to be covered in terms of their appearance, their marital status, and their children. I've just completed two studies. One is looking at the coverage of the women who ran for the U.S. Senate in 2012. There were 15 female versus male races and 3 female versus female. We just completed a study on that to send it into the book publisher on Tuesday, just in time to include this other piece of information from the survey. But what we found is that these women and men were covered very scantly in terms of stories focusing on their appearance. And this has been a trend in research that we've seen really starting in 1998 and getting much more, much less during the recent years. And so it's not even only my work, but work of other researchers are basically finding this. And so women are being described much less frequently about their, their appearance. You know, there's always the quotes that get into the media,
right,
kind of like, President Obama's. I mean, there's always those types of things that happen. But overall, and we've studied, that was a study of the major newspaper in the state. We also completed a study on television transcripts or television coverage of Michelle Bachmann. And interestingly enough, even though there were, some fairly anecdotal and fairly provocative comments made during the campaign that we all know about, when you looked at her television coverage overall and compared it to the males, it was really no more negative, no more personal than the males' coverage. One of the things we found, though, is that one of the things that with Bachmann is that actually Newt Gingrich was talked about in terms a lot of not only his appearance, but also his wife, which meant that men were being talked about. I mean, Michelle Bachmann was being talked about in terms of her image, but not any more so than some of her male rivals.
Talking about gender and politics and appearance in this case, if you'd like to find out more about the surveys just mentioned by Diane, by the Women's Media Center, Name It, Change It, we posted a link to the article on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. Also a place where you can post your reaction, your question, or dial us 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Going back to this phrase, often used phrase, looks presidential, I wonder, Diane, if you think saying a woman looks presidential would have the same effect as saying a woman is attractive.
I don't think so. And one thing I always say when we talk about this, flip it on the other side and say, would you say that about a male? So, for example, let's go back to President Obama's comment. Would he get up and introduce Tom Miller as the most handsome or the most, best looking AG in the country, or another attorney general? I mean, if you weren't going to use that for a man, then you shouldn't for a woman. If, for example, you would say a man looks presidential, then I think it's fine to say a woman looks presidential. And I agree with Bruce. That's a much more broad comment and really allows the the person who hears that comment to conjure up what that means. Presidential could mean a lot of things. I mean, it may not mean their attractiveness. It may mean that they look like someone who could run the country. And it may not be all wrapped up in their hairstyle or their what they're wearing.
Okay. We're talking about gender and politics. And let me give you a few hints, listeners, and let you guess who we want to focus on next in this discussion. Jimmy Fallon and the evolution of mom dancing. The surprise ball gown clad appearance for the final moments of the Academy Awards. All those magazine covers. And don't forget the new hairstyle. Well, First Lady Michelle Obama returning to the East Wing for her husband's second term. A focus on policy causes she has championed over the past 4 years. Continuation of her Let's Move campaign, perhaps the best known of these initiatives, which has revamped school lunches, encouraged physical activity as a way to combat childhood obesity. Here she is in Georgia in February of 2011, celebrating the program's anniversary.
Now, we're not just here today to celebrate the first anniversary of a campaign to solve the problem of childhood obesity in a generation. We're here to celebrate a new conversation in this country about the health and well-being of our children. It's a conversation about what our kids eat, how they move, about how they feel, and more importantly, how they feel about themselves. And it's about what that all means, not just for their physical and emotional health, but for their success in school and in life. And over this past year, we have seen the first signs of a fundamental shift in how we live and how we eat. We've seen changes at every level of our society, from classrooms to boardrooms and, yes, to the halls of Congress. And there's a reason I wanted to hold this celebration here at North Point Community Church. Yes, there's a reason I wanted to talk with all of you, parents from all different backgrounds with kids of all different ages. And that's because these changes are happening for one simple reason, because you asked for them.
And here is the First Lady on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon promoting the effort in a decidedly different way.
Hey guys, I'm here at the White House where President Obama and his family live. Now, as you can imagine, the security is pretty tight, but I have the highest level security clearance. Sir?
It's a restricted area. I mentioned it before, so I want you to... Right. That's your NBC employee ID taped to a Dave & Buster's gift card.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is.
Right. It's okay, Harry. He's with me.
Mrs. Obama, it is so exciting to be here at the White House.
Oh, Jimmy, thanks so much for coming. We are so excited that you come all the way here to raise awareness for the Let's Move initiative. You ready for a little competition?
Almost. I'll be right back.
So this bit continues, some competition, push-ups, a stair race, a tug of war between Fallon and First Lady Obama. Finally, she wins the competition with a potato sack race. Let me get both of your views on this. So we have about 5 minutes before we take a break. Diane Bystrom, the First Lady, evolving in her role through the Obama presidency. A different role? How so then, compared to other recent First Ladies?
Well, there was actually a lot of criticism by scholars of first ladies about how she approached being first lady in the first term. I think there's a lot of reasons for it. She was very cautious. She didn't want to, you know, I think with the nation's first African-American president, she didn't want to make any mistakes that would, harm him in any way. And so I think she was very ginger about it. I heard a woman known for her scholarship on leadership over the weekend refer to Michelle Obama as being sort of a first lady from the 1950s. Certainly, she didn't embrace policy as quickly as other first ladies, including Laura Bush and Nancy Reagan, and certainly paled in comparison, I think, to Hillary Clinton's policy stances. So she seemed to be, you know, more, again, she didn't really get, in my view, a hold of her image, and she let then the media have the image for her. And the media's image of her was focusing on her well-toned arms, her fashion, her hairstyle. And so she was really framed in those terms and not in terms of what she was doing for policy. policy. She really didn't start her policy. She didn't really have a full plan in force when she started. She picked up a couple of issues, including the one on, you know, childhood obesity and also, I think, military families. But, you know, there was a lot of criticism from her from the academic side her first term. And so I hope that she does approach more of a policy approach and stance in this second term.
That other initiative with military families, the Joining Forces initiative. Bruce Gronbeck, do you see it that way?
Yeah, very much. I think that she, in her part, it was, I think, a matter of people being disappointed that had seen her campaign and seen what she could actually do out on the hustings when she was working an audience, pushing not only I love my husband kind of themes, but pushing specific policy initiatives. And I agree entirely that she's taken very safe ones, kind of starting with the Victory Garden thing at the White House and then moving into the two that have already been mentioned. It's not as though the military families in particular is unimportant. It does have, as a matter of fact, policy implications, especially for Veterans Administration stuff and so on. But I think now she may well get turned loose on something bigger and probably larger in the general policy area. Interestingly, that article that was done recently by NBC Politics couldn't think of one. Didn't mention anywhere she might go, but I would expect her to, given that she really is an amazing force once she's in front of a camera.
Mm-hmm. River to River listeners, do you agree with these critiques of Michelle Obama as our first lady over the past 4 years going into the second term? Tell us how you agree, how you disagree. 1-866-780-9100, the larger theme arc of this hour, talking about gender and politics. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or post something on our Facebook page. I wonder if we can quickly before the break get your views on who she may be most like. You brought up the 1950s, Dianne Bystrom, not quite back that far, but comparisons made certainly with Jackie Kennedy, smart, young, attractive, focus of the fashion world. Is that a good comparison?
Yes, and actually Jackie Kennedy was actually the first lady who had a project, and her project was restoration and redecorating of the White House. Ever since Jackie Kennedy, every first lady has been expected to have a project or a policy that they'll work on. So certainly I do think, you know, there's been a lot of comments about her comparing with Jackie Kennedy. Again, that's a long time ago in the 1960s. You know, certainly I think, as Bruce said, she is actually a force that could be reckoned with. And she has excellent communication skills. She's an attorney. She's very bright. And so I think that, I feel like the people who have criticized her feel like that for all of the qualities that she brings in, she's been underutilized as a first lady in the policy arena.
Okay. When we come back, I want to ask Dianne Bystrom and Bruce Gronbeck what you think may be in store for the first lady in the second term, how she might evolve further in the next 4 years, and we would launch your opinion, your view, your critique of Michelle Obama as a first lady. One of the things we'll talk about when we come back, 1-866-780-9100. Also, that seat left open by Senator Tom Harkin's retirement in 2014. Want to talk about that. Presidential talk 2016. Is Hillary the lock on the presidential nomination for the Democrats? Also, a look back at Margaret Thatcher and what she did for women in politics. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Bruce Gronbeck, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Dianne Bystrom, Director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So glad you're warming up to your radio on this chilly, rainy day. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Wednesday. Tomorrow on this program, we'll have Neil deGrasse Tyson, many people's favorite astrophysicist. He's coming to Iowa City next week. A conversation with him tomorrow about how space will be shaped by commercial development, by privatization in the future. His thoughts on that tomorrow on this program. Also, A flood and a drought update. Funny to mention those two things in the same update, but there you have it. After this week's rains, we're going to talk about flooding and the drought tomorrow on this program. Today we have Bruce Gronbeck with us, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, Diane Bystrom, Director of the Carey Chapman Katz Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University, talking about gender and politics. And still to come in this hour, I want to talk about Maggie Thatcher's, Prime Minister Thatcher's legacy. She died earlier this week. Also, the open seat left by retiring Senator Tom Harkin in 2014. This last hour, talking about Michelle Obama, her role in politics, the role of first ladies in politics, and how Michelle Obama compares with other first ladies, and a critique of that in our first half hour. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Diane and Bruce, we have a number of people who want to talk about our first lady, how she's been doing, their critiques. Stephanie joining us from Mason City. Hi, Stephanie. What did you hear that prompted you to call?
Well, I just thought the part of your conversation where your guests were discussing kind of the weight or the gravity of the issues, the policy issues that Michelle Obama has tackled so far, and it left me with the impression that they didn't think it was very worthy. And as someone who thinks that food and what we consume and the health of our children is critical, not only for our current generation, but as these kids grow and become our future population that will have to deal with healthcare issues, I can't think of too many other issues that are as important as that. And I would disagree that her issue when it comes to childhood obesity is not important, and I would encourage her to keep it up.
Okay, Stephanie, thank you for that view from Mason City. Diane, a chance to respond to that.
Yes, and I want to clarify. I think that's a great issue, too. What I was trying to articulate, and probably I've obviously not very well, is that she was very slow to choose an issue. And so most first ladies come in with an issue, and it's fully articulated when they come in. So she would have jump-started that, saying this was her project. She kind of, like as Bruce pointed out, she had kind of a victory garden, then she kind of talked about the childhood obesity, and then she was military families. I mean, what I'm saying is that she really wasn't fully focused on what issue she wanted to embrace. I do think that childhood obesity is probably her strongest issue right now. It certainly is an issue for this country. Obesity in general is. It also links into health care. So I think it's a very powerful issue for her. And I think the military family one is too. My criticism was more that she was very tentative and really didn't, you know, she kind of was all over the place and really wasn't focused at the beginning of the first term on what she wanted her issue to be. I think she's more fully focused now.
Okay. Stephanie in Mason City, thank you for that call.
Thank you.
John is with us, also from Mason City. What is it with Mason City today? Hi. Glad to have you with us, John.
Well, it's cold and wet here. That's why we're listening to the radio.
I think we're all statewide in that state, but
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to talk about Hillary Clinton when she was first lady and how she had an issue of health care, and she worked very hard to come up with some decent policies to reform the healthcare industry, and was just hammered by the people on the right, just absolutely hammered. And I would think that Michelle Obama probably recalls that, remembers that, and thus the tendency to be somewhat tentative.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, John, for that observation. Let's go back to listen to a little bit more of Michelle Obama. The First Lady was one of the most potent speakers on behalf of her husband's reelection. This is part of her speech at the 2012 Democratic National Convention when she talked about her own modest upbringing.
My father was a pump operator at the city water plant, and he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when my brother and I were young. And even as a kid, I knew there were plenty of days when he was in pain. And I knew there were plenty of mornings when it was a struggle for him to simply get out of bed. But every morning, I watched my father wake up with a smile, you know, grab his walker, prop himself up against the bathroom sink, and slowly shave and button his uniform. And when he returned home after a long day's work, my brother and I would stand at the top of the stairs of our little apartment, patiently waiting to greet him, watching as he reached down to lift one leg and then the other to slowly climb his way into our arms. But despite these challenges, my dad hardly ever missed a day of work. He and my mom were determined to give me and my brother the kind of education they could only dream of. And when my brother and I finally made it to college, nearly all of our tuition came from student loans and grants. But my dad still had to pay a tiny portion of that tuition himself. And every semester, he was determined to pay that bill right on time, even taking out loans when he fell short. He was so proud to be sending his kids to college, and he made sure we never missed a registration deadline because his check was late. You see, for my dad, that's what it meant to be a man. Like so many of us.
Michelle Obama, a little portion of her 2012 Democratic National Convention speech there. Bruce Gronbeck, you specialize in looking at the messaging, political rhetoric here. Definitely a natural political talent here with an articulation, passion, all of that you want in a politician.
Right. I think that's why, as I was saying before the break, that she has tremendous potential. And, and they've simply got to decide, she and her staff, and I suspect broader consultation than that, how far she can go. She's when I was talking about her, it was nothing wrong with the issues at all. What I was saying that she really wasn't spending time working in a strongly political fashion, becoming an advocate in the way, say, that Lady Bird Johnson became for highway beautification, ready to help support specific pieces of legislation to send through Congress. And I think she's in a position to do that. And she, I think, as in the case of the childhood obesity, has now gone from running around and telling schools to get rid of so much sugar-filled soda to talking about specific initiatives that governments, both state and national, can be taking. I think she's beginning to move into the political arena, and I think, with her gender issues as well, there are still plenty of areas where workplace issues could use support if she wanted to move into those. And I'm sure, of course, that once we get near 2014 and beyond, that she'll also be helping with candidate recruitment, especially female candidates. She's already begun some of that. So I'm just saying that there are more places for her to open up and to become politically active. We saw with Hillary Clinton maybe somebody who went too far too fast, and that's certainly why she got slammed. And finally, in Patrick Buchanan's famous "We get two Clintons for the price of one" speech at the Republican convention. She, I think, is in a position to have a tremendous influence.
Bruce Gronbeck, one of our analysts, along with Diane Bystrom, with us this week on Politics Wednesday. Another Diane joining us by phone. Diane in Iowa City. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to say one thing seems consistent because I've been in and out of politics in several different states, but mostly Iowa since the 70s. And no matter what any woman does, she can be guaranteed she's going to be resoundingly criticized. I had the good fortune of traveling a little bit with the First Lady prior to the original caucuses in 2007 and 2008. And I really find that Bruce's comment by calling it the Victory Gardens, and everybody's tried to fix it up, but it just absolutely diminishes the gravity and the seriousness and the consistency of Let's Move, the idea of having a garden. I was traveling with Marion Barrows the day that they first announced that they were doing the garden, and there was this major criticism in the Washington Post, paid for by members of the agricultural chemical industry, just trouncing on her, saying that if she's doing this, she's suggesting that organic food is somehow good for us. So it doesn't really matter what you do, you're going to get trounced on. And I think the woman from Mason City said it very, very well. What could be more important? I mean, Michelle Obama declared herself the mom in chief. We've got to take care of our children. And she has put forward a very consistent message of good, nutritious food, absolutely available, moving for children, getting them out in the wild and nature. It's all a very consistent package. And it is ultimately both political and personal. And doing it at that level first changes the climate so that you can then maybe promote something that is from the government. If she had come out first promoting government programs, mm-hmm. I think she would have been trounced in okay. the media for that.
Thank you, Diane from Iowa City, for that view. A quick reply. It sounds like you may want to respond to that, Bruce, before we have to move on. We want to talk about Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, as I said, Hillary Clinton went out fast and really got probably did. I certainly agree she shouldn't be moving out. As for the Victory Garden comment, that was the parallel that she did indicate. Growing at home, both for to help your family's income and so on, and to have fresh, nutritious, and yes, organic vegetables for your family. So I think there's nothing wrong with that. That was an easy place for her to start, if you didn't mind her plowing up the lawn. And I think it just began to open exposure for her now that has gotten wider and wider and bigger and better as time passes.
Let's get to Margaret Thatcher, her legacy, the death of Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of Britain in the 1980s. Becoming known as the Iron Lady for her tough economic policies, also her partnership with President Reagan, standing up to communism, and that short war with Argentina over the Falkland Islands. In this speech from the floor of Parliament on November 22nd in 1990, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher defending her economic policies, casting the arguments against those policies made by a colleague in this way.
All levels of income are better off than they were in 1979. But what the honourable member is saying is that he would rather the poor were poorer, yeah, provided the rich were less rich. That way you will never create the wealth for better social services as we have. And what a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That is a liberal policy.
Margaret Thatcher from 1990. Diane Bystrom, what made Margaret Thatcher such a remarkable leader? How much did it have to do with her being female?
Well, I think she was not only female, she's the first and to date only female prime minister, but she's also viewed as being very tough. And she's got some great quotes that have amassed her over time. Some of my favorite ones are, if you want something said, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. She also was famous for saying that if you just set out to be liked, you'd be prepared to compromise on anything at any time and you'd achieved nothing. And so these comments to me, I mean, she was a real a forerunner for women in politics. And the fact that of, you know, United States is a relationship with Great Britain to this day, I think she served also as a role model, not only on the world stage, but also to American women. She was tough. She was no nonsense. She was conservative. But I think that, you know, she opened, I think, the doors. I think every time a woman does something, Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, and achieve something, it opens the door for all women. And I think she certainly did that on a world stage.
Bruce Cronbeck, what will you remember Margaret Thatcher most for?
Well, I think in terms, if we start with the gender issue, that she was the Iron Lady. They kept her as a lady, you know, even though they wanted to emphasize her toughness. And she certainly showed that. Or even a joke her husband told him when he was asked if who wore the pants in the family. He said, well, I do. But he said, but I also iron them. As a follow-up. And she... For me, what becomes most important is that she's not simply a prime minister, but she becomes associated with Thatcherism. This becomes part of the beginning of the conservative retaking of government, the conservative revolution. It hits this country a little bit later, and we tend to associate it with the coming of the Gingrich House in 1994. But she had the strength and vision, as well as political prowess, to bring not only liberal and labor party members along with her thinking, enough at least to keep securing victories, but also managed to weaken the trade unions in Great Britain, which were enormously powerful, and a series of other industrial changes that remade the country in ways that many other places, including many aspects of the American economy, have followed. And it's that association with a with a political and yes, social and even psychological mindset that became associated with her, I think that is a really an absolutely enduring legacy.
I wish we could talk longer about Margaret Thatcher, remarkable politician, and but I do want in the last 5 minutes to get to another topic to bounce these off you, Bruce and Diane. Senator Tom Harkin's retirement, leaving in an open seat for the 2014 race that hasn't happened for decades here in Iowa. Congressman Bruce Braley declaring that he is in the has his hat in the ring for the Democratic Party's nomination. On the GOP side, Congressman Steve King, I think, still thinking it over. Any possible women contenders for this open seat also will have an open seat created by Bruce Braley in Iowa's 1st District. Diane Bystrom, your thoughts.
Well, certainly I think what we're looking at for the Harkin race, since Bruce Braley has already declared for it, I don't think we'll see any other Democratic candidates get in that race. So I think the focus on now is on the Republican side, some of the people that I think could come forward. One, of course, is Kim Reynolds, Lieutenant Governor. I've heard, though, that she may be more interested in running for governor. You know, Iowa is one of only 4 states that have never sent a woman to Congress. And when you look at states that have done neither Congress or governor, there's only 2. So we haven't done either here. So Kim Reynolds is a name that comes up. Certainly there are some strong women Republican leaders, I believe, in the House. One would be Linda Utmeyer, of course, in the House. Another one might be a Marionette Miller Meeks. She's run twice on the Republican side. She's in a director, I believe, of a health in the health department now, or in some role there. And so, you know, those would be the women, I think, on the Republican side that come to mind. It's really disappointing. I hearken back to where we were, you know, several years ago. It just seems to me in Iowa is that we have all these lost opportunities for women to run for Congress. Since I've been here, in the 16 years I've been here, every woman except one has been running as a challenger against a well-financed incumbent, and that's almost impossible for women or men to win as challengers. Only about 15% of challengers, be they male or female, win. And we've had several opportunities, always in the first district where we'd had an open seat race, and you know we'll have women running as challengers, you know, 2 years before it, and then when the open seat comes up, we don't have any women, and that appears as what we have.
So regrettable, regrettable as a nonpartisan comment that women are not represented from Iowa in Washington. Do you come to the conclusion that this is a fluke, or some real explanation about what sets Iowa apart, one of only 2 states that has never done it?
Well, I actually just got a study today that I'm anxious to read. It's called The Multiplier Effect, and really what it says, and I think there's some truth to it. I've just read kind of the executive summary, and what they basically say is for women to kind of break the barrier, and they said it's not random that states that tend to elect women and don't elect women. And they say that the states that tend to elect women have a woman that's been the broken barrier. And to kind of go back on that, when I came to Iowa State University in 1996, Iowa was one of 6 states that never sent a woman to Congress. And another state was New Hampshire, who, of course, shares a lot of similarities with Iowa in the presidential process. They elected Jean Shaheen as governor in 1996 and then later elected Jean Shaheen to the Senate. Now they have 2 women senators, 2 women congresswomen, and a woman governor. New Hampshire has climbed from being one of only 6 states in the country back in 1996 to being the same group with Iowa to now they are the first state in the nation that has an all-female delegation in the U.S. Congress and a woman governor. And so I really do believe that it's sort of this broken barrier effect. And I think that until Iowa elects either a woman governor or a woman to Congress, we're just going to, you know, lag behind. You know, there are other cultural factors. You know, Iowa is really, as far as our cultural factors in Iowa, we're really rated as sort of an average state for women. So, I mean, average is better than below average, but we do have some challenges here in electing women to office.
Bruce Gronbeck, we have just about a minute left. Your observations on this question of why Iowa is an outlier.
Well, you know, I think that's really hard to say. I tend to put a lot of pressure on the parties themselves. Women like anybody, like males, making their way through the political process have to be helped by their own party. They have to almost always pick up on Tip O'Neill's "All politics is local." They begin locally and then get shoehorned along the way with help from their party to get to better and better offices and play work up that way. You know, somebody like Bonnie Campbell running for governor, what, 94? 1974, I think is right, had that. She was helped in, became the attorney general, made the jump to run for the governor, put up an awfully good race, and was only but beaten by a sliver. And that she'd certainly done better than any other woman at that kind of office level in the state of Iowa. The party's got to be enacted. There certainly is other kinds of support throughout the state. Pressure groups and financing groups that are willing to help. But until the parties take it as a serious choice and a serious demand on them, I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay, very quickly, because we don't have more than time for a one-word response from either of you. A couple words. Will Hillary run in 2016? Diane?
I think it's too early to tell, but I think she's considering it.
Bruce?
I think she's considering it, and I'm willing to bet that she probably won't.
Okay. That another chapter in that to be continued on a future edition of Politics Wednesday. Thank you for joining us, Diane Bystrom. Bruce Gronbeck, Diane Bystrom of Iowa State University. Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa. Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. And Ames help from Jason Burns, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join us tomorrow when I'll have a conversation with Neil deGrasse Tyson, everybody's favorite astrophysicist. He'll be in Iowa next week. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.